Stay tuned to Vinyl Community Podcasts.
All right, buddies, welcome back. We are back in the building. This is Concert Buddy, the one, the only. We are on Vinyl Community Podcasts. This is the series I bring to the table, right, wrong, or indifferent, called Mind of the Record Collector. And I've got a new, different voice, and you've probably heard on this series, and that's a different continent. I mean, we're going all out. The budget is blowing through the roof. Now, we obviously couldn't fly our guest, or I couldn't fly to meet him, so we had to use technology. But I'm joined by one of the best in the VC. That's Harris Pilton. Harris, how are you?
Hello, Charles. Yeah, good, mate, actually. Good to meet you at last.
Yes. We've corresponded for a long time in the comments section, yeah. Right? So it's good to actually put a face to the conversation and a direct voice.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, one reason I wanted to have you on the show and have you in the series is because it's a different approach. Obviously, I'm quite tunnel visioned on my record collecting experience and music consumption experience here in the States. So I'm super excited to kind of pick your brain. And we kind of talked about this in the lead up to this. It was what's different. And we'll kind of get into that. But before we do, let's just do if folks listening, you're new, you haven't heard of Harris Pilton or seen this channel on YouTube in the vinyl community, let's just kind of start there. And what motivated you to just start making videos talking about records on YouTube?
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I can never quite remember, but it was probably, I think it was pre-lockdown actually. And there was this sort of girl. She was amazing, and I can't even remember her channel name. But she was like this little kid who just was getting into music, and she was getting into stuff like the Jam. She was in America, and I've checked. She's deleted all her videos, and she was like probably about 16, 17, and she was just buying like the Jam, Big Star, stuff like that. And it was like, and she kept going on about the VC, vinyl community, and I was like, I don't know what this is or how do you join it and anything. So I started like Googling vinyl community, and you tend to get the big hitters when you do that near the top. Yeah. So I think it was probably Vinyl Richie I first started watching seriously, because I'm a bit of a punk, American alternative punk fan, and I'm a technological idiot. I'll be honest. I can't even do a spreadsheet, and so I'm watching him. I'm thinking, you know, how does he? It was like wizardry to me. Like how do you do it? And I think I watched one of his videos, and he then revealed that his camera was being rested on a bag of rice. And I thought, I'm not sure if this guy's the technological marvel I thought he was. Maybe I can give this a go.
And low bar. Vinyl Richie leaving a very low bar for the rest of us to climb over, yes.
Yeah, no, I love his videos. But and then there was Steve Carlton. This was during lockdown, I think, the last year. So 2020, he did a how to join the vinyl community video. It's fantastic. Typical of Steve Carlton, who I know a little bit in comments. He was supremely generous, didn't big himself up. He just wanted people to join, and he made it look so simple. I thought, you know what, I'll give it a go. And I did. And I was a little bit sneaky. I left a comment on his channel saying, oh, I've just done a video, thinking he might follow back. And he did follow back. Yes. And you know what? He's commenting on every video I've done since. So that's the size of the bloke. He's a great chap.
Steve is one of the best. And I kid with him because same thing when I got to know him. I actually got to know him, you know, when he had that unfortunate situation. His home got flooded.
And
I heard other people in the community before I started making videos. And he, you know, I think it was Mazzy or somebody had mentioned him. And I'm like, I don't know Steve Carlson. Looked him up and sent him some records. And long story short, I mean, as you can attest, he's a super nice guy. Yeah. And if there's a better ambassador for what the vinyl community should be than Steve, I haven't met him, because Steve is generous with his time. He's generous with records. He watches, I mean, I don't know how he has much time in a day. He's watching all your videos, watching all my videos, and he's commenting.
It's remarkable, isn't it? I don't know. He sent me, it's actually one of the people I've emailed. I don't email a lot of people, but I emailed him once when he's doing his move, and he's emailed me back saying he's going to give me a Fela Kuti top 10 for me to buy, because I'm just getting into Fela Kuti. So again, you know, he's a nice chap. He's a really nice chap.
Yeah, he's the best. Yeah, I call him the mayor. He kind of shrugs at me like, you're the mayor of the vinyl community for sure. So since you've been doing videos and kind of getting to know other people in the community that way, what would you say are the best or even not best parts of the YouTube experience so far? And feel free to talk freely, because I think everyone has a different experience, but I think we also have some shared experiences there too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I saw Tennis You. I think, you know, there was a big, you know, you did a video with, I think, Steve, is it the Vinyl Chef Steve, about community. And I think I hinted to you, I think my idea of what the vinyl community should be, and maybe yours is slightly different, not a criticism in the slightest, but I think we got maybe slightly to, you, I mean, you. I watched that video, it was really interesting video, and you're not alone. A lot of people have the same view, which I would call like a utopian view, you know, sort of everyone should kind of get along. There should be this shared knowledge. And I've heard people say something like, well, you know, you're not in the community. You should be this, you should be that. No, that's not necessarily yourself, but, you know, others. And, you know, my idea of a community is, I mean, the vinyl community to me is always going to be just a reflection of the community, any community. Do you know what I mean? Sure. And as you know, 99% of the community out there is lovely and 1% aren't, are idiots. And as you also know, that 1% can often, you know, what do they say? An empty vessel makes the most noise. They can often say, oh, I'm quite pragmatic about that. My idea is, I've grown up in vinyl culture for 40 years. I started buying records when I was 11, you know, 10. A lot of vinyl fans are quite, you know, quite quiet guys. They don't, you know, I've met a lot of guys. Vinyl buyers by nature can often be, you know, quite quiet chaps. And I think the vinyl community offers a great sort of space for someone. If you don't want to get involved in everything, just put a video out, talk about music, and just see what happens. And I think sometimes, you know, I personally, you know, I don't particularly want to get involved in streams. And I think it could potentially be off-putting, you know, potentially. I love the streams, by the way, I watch it. But I think, you know, you don't have to do VCLT. You don't have to get involved in threads. You don't have to get involved in competition. You know, I like the idea of a community just be, as far as, I mean, one of the great things about the VC is you don't really, it doesn't really exist. I mean, people have come on to my comments section and said, how do you join the vinyl community? And I've said, I haven't got a clue, mate. All I do is say, hello, vinyl community, and put vinyl community in. And I think that's quite good, because it means there's no sort of gatekeeping. Like, if you, I don't know if you've ever joined a vinyl group on Facebook. It can be nightmare. Oh, yeah. You've got to get through, and then everything you get is being looked at. And then you'll show an album, and someone will come on, oh, do we have to see that album again? La, la. And it's like, they're really moderated. And YouTube effectively isn't moderated, really, if you know what I mean. I mean, there's exceptions, but, you know, and I think that's quite healthy. And you can just, if you're just, if you just want to whack a video up and leave it at that. That's my idea of being in the vinyl community is stick up a video, be polite, and if people comment, put a comment back. That's all, you're golden as far as I'm concerned. That's all you need. And I think it's a really, you know, I'm not so bothered about everyone getting on and, oh, you've got, you don't respond to threat. You know, it doesn't bother me in the slightest. You know what I mean?
You raise a really good point. Well, you raise a couple good points. Let's touch on one of them, the Facebook groups, because you're dead right that there is so much politicking and, oversight, because I just saw it the other day. Somebody posted a record. And I forget what group it was I was in, but in the comments section, they were just torn up because they called this person a flipper, and they said, you know, the rules of the group are this, and then they had the bylaws like it was like parliament, right? Like they're like literally like legislating. It's like, this guy just wanted to sell a record. Like, here's an idea. And I think this I try to do my presentations. I'm sure you're probably the same milk. Just don't be a dick. Like, it's not that hard. If you don't like it, don't watch it, or don't comment, or, I mean, because why throw any kind of animus into the, you know, especially like you said. And the other thing I wanted to touch on what you said there is, and it took me a while to figure this out, a lot of the vinyl culture, like you said, and collectors are quiet and reserved by nature, absolutely. Right? There's a lot of, I didn't really pick up on this at first, because here I'm watching people doing videos for years. I'm like, okay. And I think I can do this, and I'm assuming people are very outgoing, and for the most part, when you directly interact with them, they are. But yes, a lot of people in record culture, in particular, at the shop level, at the record fair level, even on the YouTube level, are generally—I won't say generally—not the right word—but there's a lot more introverts than I had anticipated. And
that's the word I was looking for, Charles. Introverted, which doesn't mean you're lonely. It doesn't mean you're sad. It just means, you know. And let's be honest, a lot of this stuff, we're putting records on it 12 o'clock at night, you know, it kind of would suit an introverted character. And, you know, no. I think sometimes, you know, there's this, I see this thing, oh, it's the vinyl community and, oh, you know, you've got to get involved in this and that. And I think that it could be potentially off-putting. I like all those elements, by the way, but I think it's nice to just recognize that people just whack a video up, be nice, treat people with respect. You're done as far as I'm concerned. That's all you need to do. And as sure. I always say, respond to your comments. I mean, that is the one time I think you got to respond to your comments. But that's it. That'll do for me.
I'm funny. So along those lines, now you've been doing it for – how long have you been doing it? So since lockdown, essentially, a couple of years?
It was January 2020.
Okay. So in that time, like a lot of us – you probably learned some things. If you could give 4 years ago, Harris, some advice about things you've learned or maybe a real central thing you've learned along the way, you could give me that feedback back 4 years ago. What would that look like? What would that be?
Yeah, it's difficult because I kind of set my stall out pretty early, I think, because I just thought, I mean, the first thing I thought you can record yourself. Watch it back. If you don't like it, just delete it. And that's quite a good, that's quite a privilege, really, because it immediately occurred to me, I can probably make a bit of an idiot of myself and take a gamble. And so I think even my early videos, I think I reviewed a pot noodle before showing the vinyl. and then I showed some Lynx deodorant, which was Marmite flavored Lynx deodorant. So I set the bar fairly low from the word go. And I've kind of kept going on that level. I mean, the one thing I've learned is although people might consider my channel fairly successful, I get about 800 to 1,000 views per video, something like that. I didn't get 100 subs for 30 videos. Mm. And I get, even now, I get about 330 subs a year. That's all I get. It's just a slow drip. And I see channels, you know, after 3 months, they got like 400 subs and maybe 200 views. And they get, you can tell they get disheartened. But I think there's been a different, I think people expect to get big quite quick. I've noticed it more in maybe in the last year or so, maybe where the VC's getting more and more popular all the time. And quite honestly, I just tonkled along, really. I mean, I think it's a good idea to keep your, my personal thing, I wouldn't chase subs. I would always try and keep your views above your subs, because the views will pull the subs up. The subs won't pull the views up all the time. You'll see a lot of people with 1,000 subs and 100 views. But if you've got like 100 subs, aim for 200 views. And if you get 200 subs, and if you're willing to just be patient with it, I think, you know, I've seen channels that will generally just crawl it up. But yeah, I think some people will just flash in really and expect a lot. And it's really difficult to make that happen. I mean, I think you'd agree. I mean, it's hard work, isn't it?
100%. I think that, I mean, patience is important. I mean, the main thing, and you kind of said this earlier, is do what you want to do. And I think that a lot of people fall trap, because I did it. I'm like, oh, how do you get more subs? Like, how do you promote your channel? So I did some deep diving, and yeah, there's a lot of good information. But at the end of the day, I say this all the time: if it's not fun, you should mix it up. You know what I mean? Or, you know, or do something different, or that kind of thing. And I think a lot of people, to your point, get very fixated on the numbers to their detriment, right? Like they get so locked in that it discourages. And some people, like I've seen channels come and go in the 2 years I've been making videos, but I've been watching for longer, right? And it stinks, because I think those people had a lot to offer. They just couldn't arrest that feeling of disappointment in their own self and then kind of figure out a way to make it work for them. So yeah, it's a shame.
And you're right. I've never fixated on numbers, although it's not a bad idea to look at the analytics at some point once they start making a bit of sense. And to be honest, the analytics can look a bit baffling at first. But, you know, I started noticing I do these 3 or 4 minute rambles. And as you know, you've got about 30 seconds to get people's attention, because I don't know about yours. My analytics does that. And probably most people's do. So maybe, you know, I looked at that and thought, oh, let's cut down the intro-y bit. And get if you've got some decent stuff, get it up first. It's not like a movie. No one's waiting for the ending in the VC. Nobody's waiting for the ending. They're not going to sit through the plot. If you've got a Beatles Butcher cover, bang it up first.
Yes. You only get one chance to make a first impression. That is exactly right.
I see that with people that are new. I think they think, oh, I'll leave the good stuff to the end. Everyone's disappeared at that point, mate. Believe me. It's gone. But and thumbnails are underrated. I use the YouTube suggested ones now, and sure. I think your title's quite important.
Yep.
I think it's because let's face it. No, the first thing people see is your thumbnail and your title. And I'm really into SST records. If I put my top 10 SST records and show Sonic Youth, Dinosaur Jr., Meat Puppets, Firehose, Minutemen, I'm going to get about 400 views. If I put my top 10 alternative records, show the exact same 10 records. You've got to be a bit more general. And the fashionable thing is to say, I don't care about views or subs. And in a way I don't, but I only do this to talk to people about music. So you want to get more views and subs. I think the difference for me is I don't do other things. I don't do Instagram. I don't do contests. I just put a video up and I think, if you want to hop on, please do. If you don't worry. But I just do it hoping people will hop on. So I do want to get as many views and subs as possible, but just kind of on my own terms, I suppose, would be
sure.
a good
sure.
way of putting it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. One thing that I was excited to talk to you about, and we can kind of dig into it, and then we'll talk about maybe your own record collecting journey coming up. The UK VC, I know some people call it VC UK. And I don't want to paint it with a broad brush, because I think that it can errantly lump everyone who is literally across the pond at you know what I mean? So what do you think of when I say that? And it's almost like an extension of the vinyl community. Like, there's no membership required. There's no kind of preset criteria. I know there's a couple different little pockets of folks who live stream and do their thing, right, wrong, or indifferent. But first of all, VC UK, UK VC, what does that mean to you personally?
Not a lot, no. It seemed odd because obviously we're all on you. I mean, essentially, geography's irrelevant, you know. I mean, there may be language barriers somewhere along the line, but I mean, it's always a bit of a red flag to me when I start seeing things like UK VC. It doesn't make a great deal of sense to me. To be, I'm not sure. It seems quite passive aggressive. Maybe you might argue, but it's yeah. I mean, as I say, geography is irrelevant. I'm not sure what the UK VC means really, apart from it's people in the UK. But then again, I'm chatting to people all over the world in the comments section. I don't know why you'd want to circle the wagons around.
Limit yourself. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Although I suspect it's more complex than that.
It probably is. And what little I know, I'm the last person who should be talking about a lot of that stuff. But I'm just curious your take, because as someone stateside, because you know, there's not like a U.S. BC or Australia. You know what I mean? So it's kind of a very unique space that those guys, and I like a lot of those guys. It's nothing personal. A lot of those guys, you know, just kind of branded, or it got self-branded. Who knows how it actually happened? But I was curious if it was painted with a broad brush that there was just like, oh, you've got a British accent? Welcome to the UK BC. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I never know. I mean, I don't. Yeah, I'm not a one for streaming. Going on streams anyway, to be honest, which is part of what I've talked to, because actually I am terrified of going on a stream. I don't mind admitting it.
Wow, terrified.
I've never been on one. No, I've never been on a live. I think I did one with Michael, and that was it. And that wasn't a stream as such. That was
live,
but people weren't joining. So you know what I mean? So I don't like the sound of it, to be honest. It's not for me. But
that's fair. And there's a lot of folks that I know that will just stay in the gallery of those things. See, I appreciate that. You know, like, because you know, people have their reasons, right? An extension of that question I just asked, and this is kind of one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you, was obviously we have different perspectives of our collecting, and we'll kind of get into that. But just in terms of what you see on YouTube in the vinyl community, is there really, outside of the bands and the music being talked about, is there any kind of differences really? I mean, we're all kind of music fans. We all enjoy different styles of music, because like your channel, for example, like you're one of the, I could literally count on one hand channels I see talk about hip hop regularly. You're one of them.
You know
what I mean? Like, it's that small. So
yeah,
just from that view, how different do you see like what you do versus like a lot of us do stateside with your channel?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, I mean, if I could speak sort of quite generally UK, US as well, because I was thinking about it before, actually, because I think there is, I mean, the first thing is, in terms of the records, I think if you watch Ian Stream, and they do a year, Ranking the Obscure, yep, they show a lot of singles, where America's very much an album-based culture, I think, where England is singles-based, which I find, I was thinking about it, and I think there's a reason for it, is because in America, you could get in the charts, so is it the Hot 100 or whatever, on airplay alone, just airplay. In England, you couldn't do that. It had to be physical product, so you had to get, I mean, I worked on HMV for like 10 months, and I was on the 12-inch, and the 12-inches were, they were like, we were getting pushed, because that was your way into the chart. You had to sell a product to get in to the British charts. So that's why we have so many 12-inches and singles. And that's why all the lads on those streams show a lot of, and 6-inch Pianist, Madam Sin. It's a really, Britain was quite a single-based culture because, as I said, you had to sell singles to get, it's the only way you get in the charts. And then you get in the charts and you get on Top of the Pops, and like a quarter of the country was watching Top of the Pops.
Sure.
And then if you're on Top of the Pops, you're up. So, you had to do it. So that's one thing I noticed. I think America is a lot more album-based, in terms of what they show. In the UK, we obviously there is a lot of albums shown, but there's a lot more singles. And as you know, I show a lot of 12-inch singles. I mean, I think 12-inch singles are like the crack cocaine of vinyl. They're just like, they're amazing. They're cheap. You're going to get like some remix on there, which is, and they sound phenomenal because you're getting like 6 minutes of music on a 12 to. I don't care what MoFi, Mobile Fidelity, or that, they ain't ever going to make anything that sounds as good as an 80s 12-inch single. It's not possible. I mean, maybe they might pull it off occasionally, but you're paying like £2, £3.99 for these things. So they're just incredible. And I show them a lot. And sometimes, an American will comment and say, oh, is that like a promo? I'm like, no, we're flooded in these 12-inches over here. And in America, I think they kind of petered out around 87, 88.
Well, they still, I think the mainstream, but yeah, DJs were still getting them. Like you can still find 90s singles, but by that point it was very niche, right? And only people really spinning those, at least collectively, were like DJs. So I made a video, I went to a record show and you're gonna laugh, but Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, Good Vibrations, only place you can get on vinyl, 12-inch single. And you're right, it sounds magnificent because it's got all that room to breathe. So people can laugh at me for that one, but I principally remember, because I don't, that's only something I've only recently kind of adapted to, is like, okay, if I can't get it on a full LP, is it on vinyl at all, yes or no? And if it is, if it's a 12-inch, it goes right on the want list.
I love them. I love, and you get a unique sleeve. They're probably never going to be repressed.
Different artwork. Yep.
They still slip through. See, people will just chuck a 12-inch in the corner and mark it up at 99p, £2, and I think they're great. But they're not for everyone, because obviously if you play it, then you've got to get up and turn it home.
True.
But it's not for everything. But so records. I think the other big one, and the thing I know is difference UK US is probably gear. I think in America, there's a lot of talk about the gear as in turntables. I mean, I do remember, I was thinking about it before I came in. I may have got this wrong, but I don't think so. I was watching Rob Walker on a Rachel's Ghost stream, and Rob Walker, he's a similar trajectory to me, I think, just bought records for 30, 40 years, probably Gazza record 3000. And at one point she said, what turntable have you got? And he looked at her, I'm sure it was Rob, looked at her fairly blankly and said, I don't know. And the looks on the faces on the stream that he didn't know. And he got up to I'm the same. By 2010, I probably owned about 4,000 records, 3,000. If you've been buying them since 1980. If you'd asked me what turntable I had, I would not have had the first idea. I've got records over there worth £700-800 that have been played. Basically, I would just walk in the shop, and if it cost £100, I'd buy it. And I've got a 1210 now in America, a 1200, you call them. And it's only because it was in a pawn shop. I'm a big dance music fan, so obviously the 1210's arguably probably the most iconic turntable ever. I'm not saying it's the best, but it's the most iconic, Technics 1200, maybe a Lind would change. This is the first time I could tell you what turntable I've got in my life. I haven't got a clue. The speakers are worth £100. this Onkyo amp's about 200. That's it. But American Arch America, it does seem more gear focused. People are very particular about their gear. Not all the time, but I think the idea that someone in America owned 4,000 records and wouldn't know what turntable they got probably wouldn't exist.
Well, I don't know. Pitchfork Mafia would come out and we'd throw them out of the US.
But I never knew. I mean, for years, I just had this Goodman's all-in-one stacking system, which was all plastic and melded together. You couldn't even separate the sections. And it had like a 16 thing, like graphic equalizer. it was amazing.
True.
It was amazing. But yeah, I just don't. And I think, I mean, I can't remember seeing too many British UK people talk about their gear, you know, talk about their hi-fi gear. I'm trying to think of one. And I'm not saying they aren't interested, but I don't think it's as – I'm not sure why.
No, you raise a good point because, I'm very similar to what you're talking about. Like, I knew about the decent turntables, and I thought that was good enough. And I know there's some people like Jason Rojas and I have talked about this. As long as your system is adequate and you're happy with it, that's really all that matters. And I think that byproduct of this vinyl community stuff like we're talking about is sometimes you kind of get drafted into that orbit of – oh, but it could sound better if you did this or if you changed the cables. And that very well may be, and it probably is. But to your point, I would rather have more cool records than a cool, you know what I mean? Like, because to me, that's where that's the real juice for me is that, you know, finding a rare record that there was only 1,000 made of and it's something I enjoy. That's where I get charged up, not having a tube amp or a certain cartridge. More part two, I'm not knocking it, you know, brings them happiness. Go for it. But yeah, you're exactly right. I didn't really talk gear, my record collector, my small little record collector orbit before YouTube. We didn't really talk a lot of gear. Maybe it would come up, oh, what kind of turntable you have, just casually, not as a qualifier of, well, you don't have a Riga. And
yeah, I mean, as I said, I know the 12. I am getting more into sound, but I mean, that's why I buy the 12s, because they sound amazing and they're cheap. And I mean, ultimately, I suppose I'm leading on to another thing, that the whole world of audiophile, which I can't, it leaves me completely befuddled. You know, it really does, because I want to get the best sound I can, but I'm not going to pay it, you know, $150 for something which, in my opinion, ain't even the best sound you can. You know, it's everything's separated and boosted. And on my channel, I mean, I said I didn't think these things sounded any good. That's before it all blew up, you know, with MoFi and that. There's evidence of me saying I've heard these things and they don't sound very good to me. I mean, if I was an audiophile, I would put the money into a decent system, and then I'd just spend the money on early-ish pressings. They don't have to be first pressings. Just if you're into Floyd, get an early 70s pressing or a 70s pressing. You're going to be fine. Or go with a reel, tape reel. I've heard Dark Side on one of those tape reels. You know that?
Reel. Mm-hmm.
Oh my god! Yeah, that's awesome. And I don't even like that side of the main.
Don't be telling me this stuff, man, because I'm going to, you know what I mean? I'm just going to plant that seed in about 6 months. I'm going to see one somewhere, and I'm like, reel to reel, come with me.
Oh, man, that was crazy. Yeah, they sound amazing, but obviously not particularly practical, if I'm honest.
Very true, very true. Yeah, well, great. Let's talk about, we'll kind of change subjects a little bit, get off the YouTube piece, and talk about your collecting journey, because you did kind of say you've been collecting since 1980, since I think you said you're 11. What started you collecting the physical media like that? And inside of that journey, did you detour like a lot of us did when CDs came in and offload records, or did you keep your records or keep most of your records? Kind of walk us through that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I never would say I collect records. I just buy records.
Okay, fair enough.
And then one day I woke up and I had a collection. It's not, I've never said, because when I think of collection, I think of like art collecting, but it's to be admired sort of thing. Whereas I always say I've got like a working record collection. Like, I only buy records for one reason, and that's to play. That's the only reason I buy. So I never call it collecting, really. I buy records, but I obviously know what you're talking about. But sure, no, sure. I never call myself a record collector. I always say I just buy records. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty much, I mean, so the British music charts were phenomenal around, I think, I've heard a few UK VC people say it. Between about 78 and 81, it was just a madhouse because punk had happened in Britain in a way that it didn't happen in America, because America's just too large. Whereas England, you know, England's got a population a quarter the size of America, in an area a quarter the size of Texas. So we're kind of, so, and we only had three television channels. So when punk blew up and the Sex Pistols swore on Bill Grundy in the afternoon show, it just went berserk, and punk was just, it just took over. I mean, it was, it, the Sex Pistols were number one, all their singles were top five. They were the headline news everywhere. And you know, the Ramones were massive in England, where in America they were playing in the back of clubs. In England, they were playing to 2,000-3,000 people. Mm. So punk sort of happened, and then the British record companies kind of lost control a bit. It was like, so that, like, for the next 3 or 4 years, the charts were amazing. I mean, they were just phenomenal. When I was about 9, so you had like the Specials, Madness, Blondie, you had Kraftwerk, you had a load of disco, like Anita Ward's Ring My Bell, stuff like that, all in the charts. If you Google a chart in Britain between, it was phenomenal. You know, Talking Heads, the whole shebang, it was amazing. And so that was around the time I was getting into music and taping off. So I started obviously buying records because they were kind of the only game in town. You know, I didn't, no one was, this was just before the Walkman. So there were, so no one was really buying cassettes that way, because the Walkman really kicked in around 81, 82. So this was around 79, 80. So I just started buying records, and I just kept buying records. And then when it really kicked off was the music press in Britain, the NME and the Melody Maker, which I still say are phenomenal. You know, they get a lot of flack, but, you know, they'd have their Trojan horse bands like The Cure, Depeche Mode, they stick them on the cover. But then on the inside, there was so much left field stuff going on. It was amazing. And obviously the Smiths then bubbled up. And that's, once I started buying the UK weeklies, I was in it. I was just buying whatever they were making album of the month from about 85 onwards. And then the Melody Maker did a feature on like American Alternative, which was like Black Flag, Husker Du, Minutemen in around 85. And I got into that, and I was just, you know, at the age of 14, I was just going into London, because I was in Southampton by now, but it's only an hour away on the train. I was picking up all these Husker Du records, Minutemen records, Black Flag records. I was just, you know, just washing cars, whatever it took to keep buying these records. And records were pretty cheap back then as well. They weren't too expensive. And then the Smiths happened. And then I just kept whatever the British music press, because the British music press is quite fashion-led. So they would just drop a band like a Hot Brick as soon as they decide. And then they just kind of got into grunge. You know, the NME Melody Maker were writing about Nirvana in 88, 89. And I sort of got into that. I mean, I bought Nirvana's Bleach Day of Release. I've got it on white vinyl. I did. And I wanted to take it back. And do you know what? I bought it for £3.99 because they thought it was the EP Blue, which has got a very similar cover. And now it's worth about 1,100 quid, I think, or something. But and then, you know, I got into that, and I was buying all these American underground records. And I just finally, I was buying, by the end, I was just buying this rubbish that I couldn't stand.
Oh,
like,
no.
These bands like Truman's Water and Screeching Weasel and Squirrel Bait. And I sort of, the NME and Melody Maker were then starting to get into house music, like dance music. And I sort of went to my first proper sort of dance club in Brighton around 92. And that was it. I was hooked. I loved house music from that moment onward. And as much as I love all those guitar records still, I just stopped buying guitar music really from about 93 onwards. And really it was then this house, techno, hip hop. I mean, I was nuts for hip hop like yourself. I'd call the golden era for hip hop.
Yes.
For me,
yes.
93. That when the Wu-Tang and Tribe brought out their albums on the same day to about 98, 99, that to me, that was the crazy era. That was amazing. But yeah, that was it. And I did keep all my records. I eventually sold a lot of my, and I kind of regret this, I had a whole stack of 90s pressings, including...
Don't say it.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, and there's some, mate, you're going to love this, Siamese Dream on Hut. I had it, black vinyl, and I sold it back to the shop. You know the Oasis album, What's the Story, Morning Glory?
Yes, yes, I have the UK.
At that shop on the front is where I bought a lot of my vinyl from. It's in Buick Street.
Okay.
I bought all their stuff, my stuff from there, and I sold it all back to them about just before prices went berserk. So about 8 or 9 years ago, about 2015, I sold a lot of the 90s stuff. So PJ Harvey, Ween.
Oh, Ween. Killer. Oh,
whoa. Yeah. I sold Siamese Dream back to them. The Killer is a band, you may not know this band, called the Drop 19s. Do you know them? They were like an American shoegaze band. I think they gave me a fiver for it. I looked on Discogs the other day and I regret it. It goes for about 250 quid now.
Oh,
but I probably got about £15 for Siamese Dream, because they were putting it on the wall for about 50 then. So they were giving me a third. So I could live with it, because I'm a pragmatic guy. I know that record shops are going to give you a third.
Of course.
At the time, so in 2014, Siamese Dream was about a 50, 60 pound record. Now it's probably 180, 200.
Right.
But yeah, so I did sell a lot of my 90s vinyl back, but I kept a lot of the, I kept all my 80s alternative, because that was my real love. That was like the Minutemen, Big Black. That, you know, I loved all that.
So as we're talking now, I mean, you don't need to share an exact number if you don't know it, but ballpark, how many records do you think you have right now?
Yeah, it's not too bad. I mean, I did sell a lot. I gave a lot away. I mean, during the 90s, I mean, people think you're mad, because like people have got today's mentality in their head. And I say, you know, I bought, I don't know, an album by Teenage Fan Club, didn't like it and gave it away. But the way I try and explain it is albums in 1990 or 93 or 95, or were viewed the way, you know, the way you view a DVD now.
Right, you know, right. It still works, but it's not as sexy, yes.
Yeah, yeah. If you'll see the Godfather series for a dollar, won't you? All three of them. That's how vinyl records were perceived. I was buying Velvet Underground first pressings for £2, and they'd marked them down from £5. I mean, but people say that's not possible. It is, because no one wanted them. The price was dictated. I could have left a box of albums in the street and no one would have touched them. No one was interested. I've seen a CD. But in answer to your question, yeah, I did get into CD around 95, mainly because all the secondhand record shops around here shut. They just closed up, and or they started selling CD only. And HMV switched to CD. It was really hard to find vinyl. Because Britain had a big dance culture, there was still a lot of dance record shops that only sold vinyl. That's quite interesting. I doubt if you had that in America, but every town or city in Britain would have a dance record shop. So you could still, but you could only get dance, and it would tend to be imports. So you were paying like $8.99, $9.99 for an import back in 95. That was a lot of money, especially if you didn't like it. There was no internet then. I couldn't check it out.
Follow up on the collection piece. Kept your records, so you're smart, but you kind of pared it down, which makes sense. What do you think about the, and I'm going to use this air quote, vinyl renaissance, right, of the last, let's call it, I mean, it's been longer, but let's just say the last 5 to 8 years, particularly like we talked about audiophile stuff before, now, and one thing I really want to get your feedback on is like U.S. jazz. The U.S. jazz, like you watch a lot of videos, U.S. jazz is very popular, the reissue stuff. What do you think about that? Not just the boom of people getting into reissues and that sort of thing, but then kind of the niche thing about jazz as being very popular, at least stateside. What are your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for it. Because I was still frequenting secondhand record shops in between, you know, 94 to 2013. And as I've said before, that I was surrounded, I'd been in strip bars with less seedy looking middle-aged men than there were in these record shops. It was quite niche. There weren't a lot of us. And it was a strange. I suppose the downside is records are now so much more expensive. You know, I mean, 2013, I was still buying stuff like Public Image Limited's second edition, like metal box, for £8, £9. You know, that's £50, £60. I like it. I like the vinyl renaissance because it's just breathed life into the culture. You know, I'll take the hit on the price, because I wouldn't be doing things like this. I wouldn't be talking to you. There wouldn't be, well, okay, there was a vinyl community, but I like that the shops are buzzy. I like it. You know, stuff's getting repressed. The problem I've got with the repress is the quality of the represses. It's really problematic for me, and it's the biggest disappointment. And you know, there are practical reasons. You know, up until 87, there were hundreds of pressing plants. Those pressing plants were mastered and done by guys or women who had been doing it since 1970. You know, yep. They were brilliant. Yep. Any pressing plant had about 100 women in white lab checking one in every five records. There's that picture of Rubber Soul on the internet where these women are checking, you know, every fifth record.
Yep.
That just simply doesn't exist anymore. There aren't that many press implants. The ones that are completely overrun. So it's not possible to have the Q&A. And the expertise is probably dead. You know, these guys or women who did the, you know, the mastering or whatever it takes. I don't know enough. But, you know, to lacquer a record, mastering, don't exist. I don't think the expertise is necessarily there. And I've got to say, I struggle with a lot of new pressings. And I know you have. I've never seen a video of you. You just had enough.
It's a catch-22, as we say here, in that I'm glad they're reissuing a lot of things, and I'm glad that more people are getting to the hobby. So there's a lot of positives. You hit it right on the head, my friend. The quality, the QA is, and you'll hear a lot of the labels who do videos and do media say that they put a lot of, I'm sure they, in their mind, they think they do, but you're exactly right that the tribal knowledge, if you will, of people who had been in those roles 10, 20, 30, 40 years, it's gone. And, yeah. And sure, they probably passed it. And yeah, but to your point, it's a numbers game. There's less pressing plants. There's less people who have had that long history of subject matter expertise. So just from that alone, there's going to be fault. Now, the one thing they can control is the quality assurance, the QA, the QC. And I got to be honest, it is exactly what you said. It's the most disappointing piece of collecting new records. It's the biggest turnoff to me for new records. I'd rather hunt for a used record. I've talked about this before.
Yeah.
It's more enjoyable to find it myself, find it in the wild, get an older pressing, because I do believe in kind of reusing things, that sort of stuff. But the quality is better. You just know it is. And nowadays, I mean, and I'm not trying to single anybody out, but like third man pressings are notorious for being warped. I don't know why. Like it's just a matter of it's science. Let them cool. Let them, you know what I mean? Let them sit there for a second. But anyway, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but you're exactly right. That's the biggest turnoff in the hobby to me today is new records. That's why last year I made a video and I was trying to talk about my top 10 new vinyl purchases. I didn't even have 10. I think I had 8 or 9. I was being very liberal with the number, but it's true because it's such a turnoff that
it is a crapshoot, mate, isn't it? I mean, yeah, and it's a shame for me because I love, there's a lot of 80s albums which are now going for 200 quid, which I'd love to buy. And I'll be honest, mate, I just don't do it. And, sure. You know, I bought most of my records between 79 to 94. I can say in all honesty, and some people disagree with this, but I never had a bad pressing. I can think of one where there was a physical, obvious scuff. So something had gone wrong. Someone's put their finger on it or something. Duh.
Yeah.
I never had a crackly pressing ever. Ever. And this was with paper sleeves, inner sleeves.
Yes.
You know, I never had one. And now it's trepidation when I put a record on. I'm just like, and I've got no reason to say this. I'm not bitter. I want these records to be brilliant because they're saving me a fortune because it means I don't have to pay 200 quid. I can pay 20 quid. But yeah, mate, I know. I think it sounds like, yeah, we've got similar thoughts on that. It's a bit heartbreaking. I don't know what the answer is either, because it's only going to get busier and busier for those pressing plants.
It's true.
I don't know.
Well, talking about the prices of vinyl going up, and obviously not to spend a lot of time on new vinyl, but new vinyl is more expensive. But the used vinyl, obviously, by attrition, or, you know, is just being lifted in that kind of orbit too. Tell me about, like, current day. Where are you finding used records, and can deals still be found out in the wild? Are those days, like, I know we romanticize about 10, 15 years ago, getting big stacks of records for like next to nothing. Those days are probably gone.
They've gone.
But and they were great days. But nowadays, I mean, do you hit on anything out and about, and where are you finding used records?
Yeah. I never buy off Discogs ever. I think it's possible in England to talk. This is what I'm finding. I've got a theory. I'm noticing, because I go to record fairs. We have a record fair just down the road here, which is really good. It's not the best, but it's pretty decent. And there's a lot of charity shops. And in England, we've got geography on our side. As I've explained, we're scrunched in.
Sure.
I'm within a square mile walk of 25 charity shops. Not all of them will have vinyl. I'm also very lucky. Do you know Oxfam, which is the biggest sort of charity chain? They're called Oxfam.
It's probably like Goodwill for us in the States. Yeah.
Oxfam is a particular name for it. I've actually got an Oxfam Music, so they just have vinyl.
Oh, wow.
So I think what happens if someone passes away or donates, it all goes to a central bit, and they probably pump out the best stuff to Oxfam Music. That's my gut feeling, because they have a lot of good stuff. And I've got to say, they're pretty sensible down there. So, for instance, they try and price under median. They've got a balancing act, because let's take this. An original of The Queen Is Dead by the Smiths. I'm thinking at the current value, that's about a £45 record, I think, an original. Queen Is Dead, 40 to 45, I believe. If they put that on at £5, they're going to have record dealers and flippers queuing around the block. If they put all the Pink Floyd's Dark Side on for a fiver, the Black Sabbath first four, if they put them on for a fiver and £10, which is what people argue they should do, they're going to have record dealers will take the lot and just flip them out. If they put them on at Discogs Median, okay, you don't pay your staff. So what they do on that one, they kind of come in around 30% under Discogs Median. So that Queen Is Dead, they'd probably put it on for about 25 to 30. So it puts the flippers off, because there's not enough meat on the bone for them anymore by the time they've paid on petrol. But it means you can get them a little bit cheaper, and it's pretty good. And I think, as I say, in England, we got geography on our side. We've got a lot of charity shops. We're all squashed in. There's going to be charity shops that people pass by. I'm sensing in America, it's harder. America, by its very nature, is a more competitive country. I've worked for American companies. That's not an insult. I've worked in aerospace companies. America's a slightly more competitive as a country. I get the feeling you've got these sort of out-of-town sort of markets and that. If they get decent stuff, probably they kind of get flooded straight away. Is that what you found?
Definitely.
In England, you've still got a fighting chance, I think. I think in America, I've watched these American videos of people flipping through antique fairs. You don't see a lot of very good stuff at all.
No.
In England, you don't either, but you find a bit more. you'll still find a Cure. You still might find a Depeche Mode, and stuff like that. I'm also finding the record fairs are interesting, because I'm finding that I think there's a lot more punk showing up. I think we've leveled off a little bit. And I think blokes who were buying punk are now about 63 to 65 years old. And I think that's the age you start offloading your collection. And I think we've hit a strain of people offloading their collections. Because I'm finding stocks getting better, and maybe prices are evening out in the UK. Stuff like Susie and the Banshees, the Specials. Well, actually, the Specials is pretty expensive at the moment. But the Cure, an early punk. I think there's... I just get the feeling that people are selling off their collections now. I'm seeing some decent stock out there, and the prices are just leveling off a bit. But I don't know. I suspect you'd tell me something different.
No, it's an interesting take, because I hadn't really thought about that. But yeah, at that kind of age demo, people do kind of start thinning the herd deliberately, because obviously they're downsizing their homes. They don't have as much space, et cetera. That's an interesting point of view. I will say, the charity shops or the thrift shops in the States, it's a bust. And it's a bust for a couple of reasons. One, so many people collecting now. Two, you've got a lot of people who, with the advent of Discogs and eBay, who would go to the charity shops to flip. So, it's a very similar kind of pattern. But there's no kind of oversight, like you said, that they were kind of putting in place there at Oxfam. And the other piece is, the antique malls. So we would have a lot of like resale shops. They were just throwing them out as true, just kind of antiques tchotchkes. And now they've kind of gotten wind. Again, you see the media and they're like, oh, vinyl is back. And then they think, it's like anybody else. I'm sure it's that way over across the pond, that they think, oh, that big stack of records that grandma had up in the attic, I'm sitting on gold. It's black gold. And it's a bunch of junk. And then they put it in their shops and it's like $10 or whatever for Herb Alpert. You know what I mean? So I'm sure it's similar in that sense. But the last straw to me, and this is a reason I don't really do the thrift anymore, is when Goodwill, which is the big national chain in the States, they set up their own website, not just for vinyl, but for video games or any kind of things that could really bring in high value. And then the competition, you're exactly right. Then it became an online battlefield.
Yeah.
And it was a deterrent. It's very similar to kind of like Whatnot. Have you done Whatnot?
I know of it. It's not as I said, I'm very lucky that I never need to buy online.
No,
that's
a good place to be. Yeah, because the online thing is the competition. Exactly right. It's also a turnoff, because I'm always looking for new places to find, places to buy. But so I'm finding everyone else is too, or a lot of people are. And so then the competition piece. I mean, even at the you were talking about the record fairs,
Yeah.
Very similar to me. That was the last bastion of still finding good deals. And they can still be found, but I call it the discogification of the hobby here in the States, is that having this in their pocket, literally they have a database that they can really check their prices. And the days of finding even dead stock of something that maybe took 3 years to catch popular wise, or something you found out about and going back trying to find it at the record stores, they're updating their prices and stuff. So it's,
yeah,
I mean, America is pour one out for the good old days.
Yeah, I mean, America is more competitive. And I say that's not me insulting America. That's just not me. As I said, I worked in aerospace for 10 years in sales. So I was, and aerospace only comes from America. Aerospace, so I was deep in the heart of dealing with America, and fantastic. I quite liked it. But I see a similar thing that I experienced there in the competitiveness. On some of the VC videos, there does seem a slightly more competitive streak, I think. And which I don't think quite exists in the UK. Don't get me wrong, people want to get records, but sure, maybe it's slightly tougher to find. I you got a chance over here, but it might get better. As people get older, I think people do sell their records off at 65. It's dead money. You can only live so long. If you're 65, okay, I'm going to live to 80. I've got 2,000 records here.
Yeah, you don't want to leave that for your kids and their kids to kind of work through. I can appreciate that. The one bubble that I've been waiting for to burst is the younger kids, and I say the younger kids, let's call it less than 25, who got into the hobby during COVID or just kind of on a whim, just through the natural, like, oh, I don't need this. It's more convenient to have all my songs in my pocket.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for that bubble to burst, and it still really hasn't. And if it does, if it would, it's not going to be great titles. It's just going to be a lot of newer stuff. You're going to and stuff that's probably not my jam anyway. So it's not like Led Zeppelin 2 Ludwig is coming up from 23-year-old. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm dreading that moment, actually. It's just all these, I don't know, like Parquet Courts, or I don't know, Vampire Weekend reissues are just clogging up.
Weekend reissues.
I don't mind Vampire Weekend, actually. That's a bit unfair, but But I know I'm seeing bits and bobs of it. But yeah, because I think a lot of kids did get disillusioned quite quick because they bought Crosleys. I haven't got a problem with the Crosley, by the way. I started with something that was worse than a Crosley. But I think they think they're going to get this amazing because they're told vinyl sounds amazing. And of course, on a Crosley, it doesn't sound great. I would encourage any kid to get a Crosley because you'll work out whether you want to get into it or not. And I say my first record player was actually, you had to build your own speakers out of cardboard. It was like a sub Crosley. It was terrible. But I do think a lot of kids buy their first 10, 20 and then just think, nah, maybe I'll stick to Spotify or something. But a lot of kids love it as well, don't they? They just, they really get into the hobby. So
yeah, no, good. I love it. Love it. All right. Well, we've made it, Harris. We've made it. Lightning round time. Now, if you're familiar, folks who may have not seen these broadcasts or listened to this podcast before, we just ask a couple of lighthearted questions, kind of round out the conversation. So I'm going to hit you with this one. Tell me about the most memorable live show that you've seen. Who was it? What made it so unique, etc.?
That is really easy because it was my first ever gig. It was about February the 8th, 1988.
The exact date.
Oh, it lives long in my memory. You'll find out why in a minute. It was Depeche Mode at the Bournemouth International Centre. And you know that Depeche Mode 101 concert in Pasadena, the album?
I'm familiar.
It's about 2 months before that. But in England, they weren't as popular as America. They were tailing off a little bit. So I saw them in this place that just took 4,000. And they were at the top of their game. And the sound was insane. It was just like the bass was ripping through. Because, I mean, they must have been cash rich, Depeche Mode at the time. But the system was insane. The most memorable thing is they had a support band from France. And the lead singer, who was female, did a striptease, which... So it really was a night of firsts for me. It has to be said.
She literally are all concerts like this? What is
happening? Yeah, I know. It was amazing. It was phenomenal. I can't remember what they were called now. It will come back to me. But it was a phenomenal gig, by the way. At the time, I didn't want Depeche Mode to come on. When they did eventually come on, I was just like, the sound. I mean, it was phenomenal. And you know, when I heard that they came on to Behind the Wheel, and I still, whenever I hear Behind the Wheel,
takes you right back.
It was crazy. It was a crazy night. It was
love it.
Nothing's come close.
All right, next one I got. And this kind of goes back, we were talking about just here a few minutes ago about finding records out in the wild. Tell me about the number one find in the wild that gave you the most joy.
Well, okay. There's a load of charity shops literally about 50 yards from me. And there's one that's always just Mantovani, Neil Diamond, always. There's no exception ever. It sells porcelain figures of weeping Italian boys. It's that kind of, you know, Scrabble, the lot. For some reason, I just kept picking through. Mantovani. I've done it for years. And this still blows my mind. In the middle, do you know the film Repo Man?
Yes, yes.
The soundtrack to Repo Man was sitting in the middle, which you never see. It's not a mega expensive record. It's probably a £40 record.
Yeah. But to find it out,
you never see it. And I love it. You know, I love Black Flag. I love the Plugs. I love Iggy Pop. It's an amazing, I mean, I love the film. To find the soundtrack to Repo Man in the middle of all this, and I had that moment, you know, that moment when you just sort of, is this happening? Then you look around.
Exactly. Yes.
And then you make a noise, and then you run to the counter as quickly as, because obviously they had it on for 99 pence, because, and this was only a couple of years ago. And I'm like, how the hell have they got a copy of Repo Man? But I was so thrilled, and it plays like a dream, and I've played it so often, and I've always wanted that record, so I was pretty thrilled.
That's awesome. All right, last one I got for you, and this is one I think I know the answer, but I want a real countryman to explain to us Yankees. Tell us a boot sale. What exactly is a boot sale?
A car boot sale. You need to be asking Rob Walker.
Well, Rob Walker's the one who uses it the most, so I'm going to ask you, because Walker will take me down a trip and I don't need to go down.
Well, actually, there's someone in the UK is better. Dale Gatefold 33. He's a real boot. So it's so basically, I haven't been to one for years. If a farmer or something owns a field, it like say, bring your cars along. You'll pay £6 or something like that to bring your car, and then you either put all your stuff, and it's, again, it'll be weeping Italian boys, ceramics, jigsaws with pieces missing.
Sure.
Trainers sell well, as you call them, sneakers. They sell well. Okay, if you've got sneakers, you can retire. And of course, you do get vinyl. And people will either put it in their boot or more likely just lay a blanket out. Asking 800 cars to turn up on a field with poor drainage may seem like a good idea, not in Britain. Where it just rains continuously. I've actually seen tractors pulling people out.
Oh my gosh.
Bob Walker lives in Manchester. He must have to turn up with a snorkel and flippers, because Manchester never stops raining, ever. It's summer because it's not torrential rain in Manchester. It's just rain.
It's just mild.
That's essentially it. You pay £6, you take your car, you lay it out. I don't go to much anymore. I used to as a nipper as a kid. But, that's essentially it. And you will get people who sell vinyl. And it can be an absolute – it's feast or famine. You'll either get people who know what they're doing, or you'll get someone whose son has left for university. He's got all his records. His mum's decided to knock them out at £2 each. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's Turquoise Zeppelin. Yeah. Would you take a tenner? Yes, love. It can be good. If you can hit a seam, it can be amazing. But yeah, that's essentially what I don't understand why America doesn't have them. Why don't you have them over there?
We have. So the only thing I can compare it to is we have what's called flea markets.
It's a
similar idea, that it's usually like a very remote piece of land. Sometimes they have buildings bought on where they sell, like, you know, food on the inside. But yeah, people just put out their wares on a blanket, or they'll have tables. And yeah, weather be damned. I mean, it could be really dusty, it could be rainy, but these people are, you know, my father explained to me a long time ago what flea market means, but I just know it was every once in a while you find something neat, but a lot of times it's a bunch of junk, and it's not really my scene.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same story. But yeah, you know, you look at if you watch Dale or Rob, they find some absolute gold dust there, to be honest. So, yeah.
Love it. Well, Harris, I'm so glad we could do this.
Yeah, definitely, man.
Great talk, great conversation. Maybe there will be more countrymen coming to the masses that want to have these conversations. Now you're the tip of the spear. You've broken the ice. But real pleasure. The channel is his name. It's simple as that. No bells and whistles. Just look up Harris Pilton on YouTube, and you will find my man. Great conversation. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Good man.
And that was another trip around the turntable. Thanks for listening to Vinyl Community Podcasts.